A prominent graffiti artist in Cuba, who was jailed after the day Fidel Castro died for actions that appeared to celebrate the late Cuban leader's death, has been put in jail, but they're talking now that they may release him in a few weeks. They almost put him to death for that. Jeez, things are still tense in Cuba. We're going to come back in just a moment and chat with St. John Hunt. He's the son of the late E. Howard Hunt. E. Howard Hunt was an author, a member of the CIA, and had a career that, well, we'll talk to you about in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. St. John Hunt is the eldest son of the late super spy E. Howard Hunt, 27-year career with the CIA, a covert agent, incredible career. And we're going to talk with his son about that. I'm not going to read the entire bio of E. Howard Hunt, because when you hear, of course, the words from St. John Hunt, you will know exactly what we're talking about. And I had the great opportunity to meet St. John in person several months ago in New Orleans at a conference on Lee Harvey Oswald, where people were talking about, you know, was Oswald a patsy or not? And St. John heads up a band there. He was playing at the event, as well as everything else he does. You play pretty good music, my friend.
Thank you, George. It's great to be on your show. And it was my pleasure entirely to meet you down in New Orleans.
That was a fun event. And I was amazed, St. John, at how many people came to similar conclusions that Lee Harvey Oswald either wasn't involved in the assassination, but definitely was not the sole assassin.
Yes, it's amazing. I think it's a groundswell. And I think, at some point, the issue is going to be pressed sufficiently enough to cause, some kind of withdrawal of his guilty verdict. After all, he was never tried and convicted.
That's right.
So we'll see.
Your father lived to the age of 88, just like my father did. Let's talk about your life as a little boy, if we can, St. John, and tell us a little bit about what you remember of your father as a father, and then we'll get into some of the many things that we're going to talk about tonight.
Well, my memories of my father growing up are very sweet, actually. I have to take into consideration that he wasn't home. He wasn't a stay-at-home father, and he certainly wasn't a 9-to-5 father. He was gone for many weeks, sometimes months on end, only appearing back at our family home, for a day or two, and then he'd be gone again. And of course, we moved around the world. I moved to Japan when I was 3 months old, and after 3 years there, we moved to Montevideo, Uruguay, and that was 4 years, and then to Mexico City, and then finally to the States, and then off to Madrid, Spain in 65. But I have great memories of my father being a very tender and loving parent. He would often play with me, let me ride on his back while he was down on all fours. And then as I grew into my early teens, he helped me a lot with my musical abilities. He sensed that I had a very sharp ear for music, as he did. He was a trumpet player, the first line trumpet player in a big band, swing jazz band, coming out of Brown University. And he went to Havana many times on these junkets and played all night jam sessions and swing dances in Havana. And then, of course, later in the CIA, he did revisit Havana, but with entirely different purpose in mind. My father could also be extremely cruel and cold and disassociative with everyone in the family or anyone else that he wanted to. He was a very complicated man. I think a lot of the things he carried out for this country were out of a deep sense of loyalty, and he really believed that the things he was involved in, such as overthrowing foreign governments, assassinations of foreign leaders, and that sort of thing, was truly in the best interest of this country to protect national security. It was only at the very end, when he was arrested in its connection with Watergate, and he was left out to hang in the slowly twisting in the sun there, that really the bitterness set in, and he died a bitter man about all the years of service that he had given this country. And then left out in the cold.
Was he an author first or an intelligence officer first?
He was an author first. He won the Guggenheim Fellowship for a book he wrote. It was the first book written by a serviceman. It was called East of Farewell, and that was 1945, I think, it came out. And he had three successful books in a row. And after that, he worked for Averell Harriman as his speechwriter. Averell Harriman was, among many things, a banker and worked over in Paris. But in the Organization of American Economic Cooperation under Averell Harriman, and that's where he met my mother. So he became involved in the CIA when it was still called the OSS. Of course, in 1945, it disbanded, but then 2 years later, the CIA started up. He was right in on the ground floor. That was in 1949. And by 1950, he was given the honor of to open up a CIA station in Mexico City. He was the first CIA officer to open up a Latin American CIA office. And that worked until 1954. I was born, and he went to Japan and became the chief of covert operations for North Asia Command in Tokyo, and by 1956 he was stationed in Montevideo, station chief down there. That's when he met Richard Nixon, who was vice president at the time under President Eisenhower.
They were close, weren't they?
Yeah. Yes, Nixon had known my father since 1956, and that's something that most people don't understand. So when you hear these Watergate tapes or these White House tapes, and you'll hear Nixon talking about the need to firebomb the Brookings Institute to destroy some sort of documents that were in there. He calls for Howard Hunt. We need Howard Hunt. And the people who are looking around each other, Ehrlichman and Haldeman, they don't know who he's talking about. But soon his name is legendary, grew within the White House circles, and he was brought on board to take control of this investigative unit that Nixon was putting together. They called it the Plumbers.
The Plumbers Unit, that's right.
Known as the White House Investigations Arm.
St. John, I've been reading a huge book called The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination by Lamar Waldron, and in it, he's got your father's name all over the place. But I was specifically interested in it when he talked about the Cuba influence and, of course, the JFK assassination. But it appears that your father, working in tandem with some other operatives, maybe with or without John F. Kennedy, the president at the time's knowledge, that one of his roles was to get Fidel Castro assassinated. Would you believe that at this point, that that's what he was trying to do?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my father, in 1959, my father traveled before the CIA to Havana, Cuba, to assess the situation over there. This is, of course, after Castro's successful coup in that country. And when he came back, he filed a report with the CIA. They had a meeting of the top brass in the CIA. My father was the first CIA officer to state unequivocally that any invasion of Cuba would only be successful if the assassination of Fidel Castro, his brother Raul, Che Guevara, and several other top Cuban military / political operatives were also taken out at the same time. And that became the basic seed for the formation of Operation 40, which was an off-the-shelf, very, very secret CIA operation to train Cubans for assassination projects. And my father oversaw part of that. And, of course, this is where Nixon comes in. He was the vice president, and he gave the green light to go ahead with that operation. This figured much, much later during the Watergate era, where my parents were blackmailing Nixon having continued paying the hush money to support the men that were arrested at the Watergate. This was the evidence they had that they were going to release publicly. And my mother, in fact, was carrying internal memos from the CIA and the White House showing that Nixon was a part of this green lighting of this Operation 40 to have Castro assassinated. And Nixon was very, very upset and very scared of my father doing this, because that would have been highly embarrassing for him, if not grounds for impeachment. Certainly, he didn't need any bad press at that point in his presidency. He was pretty well disliked by everybody at that point. But it's interesting to see in this breakdown of assassination attempts on Castro, according to former director of Cuban intelligence, Fabian Escalante, Eisenhower was responsible for 38 attempts against Castro, Kennedy 42,
jeez,
Johnson 72, and Nixon 184 attempts on Castro.
And they could not get the guy.
Yeah, Carter was approved of 64, Reagan 197. So Reagan's got the most, Bush Sr. 16, and Clinton 21. To a total, Escalante claims there's 638 assassination attempts to kill Fidel Castro.
Or plans. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Right.
Your father was very upset with the appearance that John F. Kennedy was not going to do anything about Castro.
Yes, he was. It was a personal vendetta my father had against Kennedy after the failure of the Bay of Pigs. It became personal, and this is the other thing that Nixon feared. These trained assassins from Operation 40, then along with my father and several other CIA chiefs, turned their guns from Castro to JFK. And that's Nixon strongly felt that was who was responsible for killing Kennedy. And as we'll see in the coming years, it'll be proven correct that this, in fact, was the case. It was an off-the-shelf CIA operation. That's what I believe. That's what my father told me before he passed away. And, the whole, I was doing a lot of research on Castro recently because he passed away, and I wanted to find out, why did he become a communist? Well, when you go back through the record, he was never a communist until he was forced into that position. I mean, in 1958, in 56, actually, he gathered men and he came back to Cuba from exile in Mexico after he tried to overthrow the government of Batista back then in 53. They arrested him. He spent 18 months in jail, and then they released him and exiled him to Mexico. In 56, he came back and went to the Sierra Maestra Mountains, putting his army together. So in 58, the U.S. started this tit-for-tat thing. They put a U.S. arms embargo, wouldn't let any arms in, and Castro wanted to be armed. Near day, Castro, of course, the Cuban Revolution, they succeeded in overthrowing Batista. And in his first interviews in this country and in Cuba, he denied any leanings towards communism. He was not a communist. He was a Catholic. And, as we know, communists are not allowed to be Catholics. But in 59, he visited the U.S. to obtain recognition as Cuba's leader and was refused a meeting with Eisenhower. And Nixon brushed him off. And so he was given political acknowledgement by the Soviet Union.
That's right. And he took advantage of it.
Yeah, well, the investments in Cuba, they were worried about, this country was worried about the three giant oil refineries that were on Cuban soil, and as yet Castro had done nothing to upset the balance of money pouring back into the United States. But, the United States government knew that Castro wasn't one of their puppets. And of course, in the 1954 Guatemalan coup, When President Jacob Arbenz announced his plans to nationalize the land, including the Bass banana plantations, my father was instrumental in that overthrow of that government. So the CIA had it in their mind way back in 58, 59, that they were going to invade Cuba and overthrow and assassinate Castro in order to continue the U.S.-dominated oil production from that country. But they failed. The Bay of Pigs failed. And this whole process just kept escalating. In 1960, Castro began purchasing arms from the Soviet Union, and then in retaliation, the U.S. reduced its importation of sugar down to 700,000 tons from 1.4 million tons, which was crippling the Cuban economy. So the Soviets then stepped in and purchased the rest of the 700,000 tons. So it was just one thing after another that kept mounting and escalating. until the dramatic, Missiles of October.
St. John, your mother tragically died in a plane crash in 1972 at Chicago's Midway Airport. As it was trying to land, it stalled, I believe, and it crashed. And apparently she had $10,000 cash on her at the time, and all kinds of stories have surrounded that, that plane may have been sabotaged by the CIA to take that plane down because she was on it. You have written a book called Dorothy. Tell me a little bit about what you think happened there.
Well, at that point in December of 72, it was a desperate time for not only my family, but for the families of the men who were arrested at the Watergate. We were all suffering, desperately from loss of income, and of course Nixon and his inner circle had promised a complete flow of cash to pay for the lawyers and the attorneys and the mortgage fees and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But once Nixon was reelected, they didn't seem to think that was as important. But Nixon, it can be overheard on the tape saying that. That he could come up with $1 million in cash to pay off Howard Hunt. He wasn't really worried about anybody else. He was worried about my father,
yeah.
who had the knowledge and the evidence of Nixon's involvement in the Castro assassination.
Right. He used to say Hunt knew too much.
Yes, and that's what Hunt knew, and that was the members of Operation 40 under Nixon's approval then turned their guns on President Kennedy in retaliation for the Bay of Pigs. And that's exactly what Nixon was scared that would be coming out. My mother boarded that flight with the $10,000, as well as $2 million in traveler's checks. The $10,000 was meant to pay off a guy named Michael Stevens of Stevens Research Labs. Stevens, a day or so after the crash, got a call from unknown persons saying that he better keep his mouth shut, otherwise the same thing would happen to him. He'd wind up like Dorothy Hunt. And he reported this to the FBI, but nothing really came of it. She was going to call a press conference with Michelle Clark, who was also on that flight. She was a CBS, the first African-American woman, a CBS anchorwoman. And they were going to call a press conference where my mother was going to, as she told me, blow the White House out of the water. She was tired. She'd had it up to her eyeballs in all this drama and the fact that our family was now threatened, my father going to prison, and she was probably headed for that in that direction as well. And she wanted clemency for my father, which they had promised, but they reneged on it. So the plane came down. They couldn't allow that plane to land and call that press conference. There were so many things about the landing of that plane. Many people, witnesses on the ground, many of them said that the plane actually exploded in the air before it hit the ground.
And it was a 737, first time that plane went down.
Yeah,
at that time.
Right. And the pilot, Wendell Whitehouse, was one of the most decorated United Airlines pilots in its entire United Airlines history. This guy had flown like forever, tens of thousands of hours in flight, never ever had a problem. But that plane, in my belief, was rigged. And it's interesting to note that the FBI showed up within 40 minutes of that plane crash, and they said they had authority to do so because, and this is in a letter from FBI director to the NTSB director.
Hold on for a second, St. John. We're at the break, but we'll come right back and pick it up. Fascinating story about your family. Welcome back to Coast, St. John Hunt is with us, author, of course, and researcher. Several of his books, Bond of Secrecy and Dorothy, is about his mother, whom we're talking about right now, along with his father, E. Howard Hunt of Watergate fame. And those of you who know history, of course, it goes even back further into assassination plans with trying to get Fidel Castro. So, St. John, back to this tragedy in 1972, which would have made you how old at that time?
17
years old. God. How did they notify you? Where were you when that happened?
I was at home, and I believe we got a call. I think my sister answered it, and and blurted it out in a sort of hysterical, you know,
oh my God,
a moment of hysteria. And I just didn't know really how to deal with it for years. But you know, the idea of the murder of her didn't come into my life for many, many years after that. I just put it off as just a normal
horrible crash.
You know, yeah. A horrible crash. But then in doing research, you know, it became more and more evident that this had the hand of somebody's hand in it to orchestrate this thing, especially considering that the FBI wrote a letter back to the NTSB saying that they did have jurisdiction at the crash site when they had evidence of pertaining to the willful damaging or disabling of the civilian aircraft, also pertaining to aircraft piracy, assault, murder, manslaughter, and attempts to commit murder. So that gave them the authority to be there, and of course they took control of the investigation, which then, which they gathered up evidence, as well as the very next day, Nixon appointed Eagle Crow, one of his top inside counsels, to the position of Undersecretary of Transportation, which oversaw the NTSB investigation of that crash. So Nixon had one of his top guys there looking into that and controlling the way the outcome of the investigation was going to be read. And there was many, many, many more, which I outline in the book. But, you know, this all sort of stems from the whole Castro thing. I mean, this entire problem with JFK assassination and my mother's death, Nixon, it really, the seeds were planted way back in the late 50s in this demented plan to have Castro killed, you know.
And this obsession is, as well. Next week will be the 10-year anniversary of your father's death. 10 years, it's amazing how fast time goes by.
Yeah.
And in this situation, he had what many have called, St. John, his deathbed confession to you and your brother. Tell us what he said. And, you know, in a deathbed confession, I guess you're supposed to, you know, tell the truth. And in your opinion, did your father tell you the truth when he talked to you?
Yes, in my opinion, he absolutely did tell me the truth. Because at the time, his mind was very strong. He was accurate, but you know, his body wasted away. He had the lupus, cancer, and had a leg amputated, the same leg several times.
Oh,
geez. Weakened physically, but his mind was sharp as a razor, and you know. The thing that one has to understand that if my father was going to fabricate something about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, he would have done it probably years ago, years before this, and he would have fabricated a tale that the Soviets were involved or the Cubans were involved. But he would have never, ever, under any circumstances besides the truth, would have revealed that it was his own CIA people that had orchestrated this, and so as it turns out, there's a lot of evidence from a lot of other authors too that have come up. Roger Stone for one, Lamar Waldron, which
mm-hmm.
that you had mentioned earlier, and certainly one of the good authors. I forget what his name was. He was a lawyer for the firm that LBJ. Was part of he knew Billy Saulesky. He was Billy Saulesky's lawyer. But anyways, he wrote a book about LBJ being the top guy in the Kennedy assassination. And what that means is just that Lyndon Johnson green-lighted that task to have Kennedy killed. That would have been Johnson's only chance to become president. He would have lost after Kennedy had lived another 3 or 4 years. He was just too out of the loop. And that's what my father told me in his deathbed confession. He said that it was in fact Lyndon Johnson, the code name for the assassination, at least in the early stages in the summer of '63, was the big event. And he was requested by Frank Sturgis, who was one of the members of Operation 40, who's a Cuban, as well as David Morales, who was part of Operation 40. These guys attended the meetings at a safe house that my father attended, and they talked about bringing my father on board for the big event. The other people involved, my father told me once he learned what the project was, were Ford Meyer and David Atlee Phillips, who was Oswald's handler. Phillips was handling Oswald. My father told me that as well. William Harvey was instrumental in the whole plot because he was the one that imported the Corsican gunman who some people have placed at the Grassy Knoll. So my father also told me that there was more than one team. And then, of course, that's proven to be true. There was apparently a team in Chicago and one in Tampa as well. So Kennedy was slated to go. He had to go. And my father was proud of his service in the CIA, and he didn't regret the fact that he had participated in the assassination. He never lived long enough to give me the full disclosure that I was hoping for, but with much pressure from his attorney and the rest of the family, he couldn't. He didn't want to jeopardize them and ruin their lives like that Watergate had ruined his first family.
Oh my gosh!
My family.
I think that attorney you're talking about, was that Barr McClellan?
That was a guy named Bill Snyder.
Bill Snyder, okay, because there was another. McClellan wrote a book called Blood, Money, and Power, How LBJ Killed JFK. It was a basis of a History Channel documentary, which, by the way, the History Channel apologized to everybody, claiming that those allegations were unfounded. So that was a tough situation. Have you heard... St. John, in your investigations of the mob being involved in Kennedy's assassination also, Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante wanted Kennedy out too because of JFK trying to crack down on them.
Yeah, I have. And what the story with that is the CIA and the mob have been working together since World War II. The CIA needed a plausible deniability if the assassination were discovered. Links to the CIA would be brought forth. They needed a presence that could be blamed for the assassination. And so they had continued to use Sam Giancana, who was the mob boss in Chicago, Carlos Marcello, as you mentioned, of New Orleans, and Santos Traficante. These were all mob bosses who had huge investments in the casinos in Havana. And when Castro nationalized the oil refineries, he also nationalized any American linked businesses in Cuba and of course the casinos. And so the mob wanted Castro dead as much as the CIA did. But what they actually served was very little towards the real assassination attempts. But they were kept hanging on. Sort of as bit players, just in case the CIA or the American government needed to blame somebody for Kennedy's death. You know, they think these things through very well. They would never have allowed the mob to actually participate in the assassination, because then the mob then has a huge leverage against the CIA. But they kept them involved just enough. My father worked with John Roselli on some of these assassination attempts on Castro. But they kept them involved just enough to make them think that the CIA was letting them in on this dark project. But they never really had them do anything. And that's what a lot of people don't understand, is that the CIA does its own dirty work. They do not, generally speaking, farm out to people, certainly people like the mob, who are uncontrollable, assassins. But it makes sense if something had gone wrong, the operation had been discovered, that people would learn that it was the mafia. And that would be, of course, one more reason to get rid of the mafia, as well as it makes sense. The mafia has hitmen and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, they wanted to get rid of Kennedy. That's how the CIA used the mob in this situation.
Why do you think, St. John, that the Warren Commission just went right along with the one gunman theory, Oswald, and they didn't push anything else further than that?
Well, I think because, number one, Lyndon Johnson handpicked members of the Warren Commission, and most of the members of the Warren Commission had a very dislike for President Kennedy. After all, Alan Dulles was part of the Warren Commission, and Dulles had been CIA boss. But after the failed Bay of Pigs, Kennedy had fired a lot of the CIA top echelon. My father's boss, Tracy Barnes, was fired. Alan Dulles was fired. And these guys were looking to just close this whole thing up, certainly protect the CIA. The CIA was never forthcoming in its documents it had, its files it had on Lee Harvey Oswald, or its own internal investigation into the JFK assassination. They refused to cooperate, as they continued to do so throughout the 70s. And I think some of the other members, like Gerald Ford, I think these people were just scared to look anywhere other than pinning it on Oswald. That was, in fact, the sole purpose of the Warren Committee, was to gather all evidence showing that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin. And that's why they had to come up with the single bullet theory, because even though there was many more bullets fired that day and much evidence showing that there were more bullets fired that day, that would have shown a conspiracy, that would have led to to who were the conspiracists, and who knows where it would have gone after that. So the Warren Commission was just a very fraudulent committee put together for the sole purpose of pinning it on Oswald.
In your father's deathbed confession, did he say anything specifically about his involvement?
Well, he called himself a bench warmer to me. In fact, after our first conversation about the JFK assassination, I had flown back from Florida to California, where I lived, and in a couple of weeks I received a package in the mail from my father, and it was a cassette tape. And this was completely unsolicited by me. I put the cassette tape in, and my father gave me the outline of the people that he was involved with, and that's when he called himself a bench warmer. And he said, "And I'm giving you this information to you and to you alone." So he wanted me to keep it totally secret until we decided what we were going to do about bringing it out to the public. He was very determined to bring it out, but he was never able to. Bench warmer is a very interesting term, and my father was very cagey about certain things, but he picked his words very carefully. And a bench warmer is someone that's part of the team, but that's sitting from a vantage point of view, sort of on the periphery, looking at the entire game plan,
ready to be called in anytime they needed him.
Right, and I think my father's job in the assassination was to be there, to be aware of anything that could potentially go sideways, and he would be the one that would know the safe houses to bring the shooters to, the method of extricating them, the transportation, routes that would be safe, airports that could be used, planes on hand to fly people out, and that sort of thing. And of course, he also served as paymaster in Dallas, giving an envelope of money to Frank Sturgis, as testified by Marita Lorenz.
What would you say, St. John, was the most bitter type of your father's life?
The most bitter?
Bitter point, yeah.
That he wasn't supported by Nixon in the White House or even by the CIA at that point, because, in fact, while my father was working for the White House, doing the Watergate, breaking in Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in Los Angeles, and doing a lot of other things, for the White House, he expected to have the full support of their legal team, as well as be exonerated for crimes, and he wasn't, and that was his breaking point. I mean, to realize that he had given 27 years of his life to the CIA, been responsible for tens of thousands of deaths, as exampled in Guatemala, that he ran that operation to depose their freely elected president, which resulted in tens of thousands of deaths, and killing was a way of life for him, if necessary. It was not something that he had to mull over very much. Collateral damage, people die. That's what he told me. But And then after all of that, for them to almost ridicule him, to be ridiculed in the papers as a bungling burglar and this sort of thing, for his very close friend Richard Helms, Dick Helms, who was head of the CIA during the Watergate times, to publicly say that he didn't really know Howard Hunt very well. He was kind of like thought of as kind of a sort of a guy with too many fantasies in his head, and this sort of thing really hurt him. And of course, he was reporting back to Helms through the entirety of the Watergate break-in and for the year and a half before, when he was doing all the other break-ins and all the other things he was doing for Nixon. He reported specifically back to Richard Helms. My father didn't retire in 1970 as he said he did. He went deep cover in order to gain access to the inner White House workings and report back to Richard Helms. He had done this once before in 1965 when he retired. Actually, they sent him to Spain to further the assassination attempt on Castro from Spain, where it could be done with less conspicuously in this country.
When you look back at your life with your father, do you shake your head in amazement that he did all these things?
Yeah, it's really incredible. He did all these things and did spend some time with his family and wrote 88. He had published 88 books throughout his life. I mean, that's one hell of a... I mean, there's only 24 hours in a day. I don't really know how he could have pulled all this off, but he was a very energetic and passionate man.
Where was home for all of you, St. John, when you were growing up?
Well, we were gypsies. I mean, we moved all over the country. I barely spoke the language of the country that we were in or the school I was going to. For example, when we lived in Montevideo, Uruguay, everybody around me spoke Spanish. I only spoke rudimentary Japanese, and I was going to a school.
And then later on in your father's life, did he live in D.C., or where was he?
Yeah, we lived in Potomac, Maryland. It was our first real family home where we stayed year after year. And I think we bought that house in 1966 after our return from Spain. And we lived there throughout Watergate.
Did your father like Nixon?
Yes, he did. He really liked Nixon. He was very pro-Nixon. Very honored to have been to ask to join the Nixon team, and just was sort of heartbroken when Nixon denied him the promised clemency and the money stopped, and that's when they were going to blow Nixon and all his guys out of the water, just completely open up the Watergate case for what it was, which was all these different crimes. Nobody even knew the depth and the vastness of what the plumbers had been up to. And my father was, at that point, he was about to go to prison. He'd already, testified and kept his mouth shut about a lot of things. And then, of course, when my mother was killed, he pled guilty to all charges, went to prison.
And I bet that he took a lot of other secrets to the grave with him, St. John. We're going to come back and take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.